Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about something in a way that we have discussed before on the program. We'll be talking some about the struggle to overturn apartheid in South Africa. But the kind of angle that we'll be taking really is different from conversations that we've had in the past, because we'll be talking a bit about how librarians and readers were involved in this struggle. And our guest for the program this morning is Archie Dick. He's a professor in the Department of Information Science at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be giving a talk on the subject that's part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. All these programs, they're always open to the public, and for you who would like to attend, should certainly feel welcome to stop by. He will be talking with us and in the talk today about just how significant a role information, books, reading, and the institutions like libraries did indeed play in the struggle against apartheid. He says that's something that should definitely be remembered. Questions as we talk are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people want to join in the conversation, they are certainly welcome to do that. Well, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. I am assuming that under apartheid, there were two separate library systems. There would have been a library for blacks and a library for whites?
Well, in fact, there were probably more than two, depending on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. There were certainly libraries for whites. And after the promulgation of certain laws, there were libraries for each race group. So there were libraries in black areas, libraries for Indians and libraries for coloreds, mm-hmm. as well as library for whites. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And did people of different groups go to different libraries, or could you not do that? Were you only required or only allowed to go to essentially to go to the library that was for you?
Well, that's very interesting. You know, in Cape Town where I grew up, there was always a liberal tradition from the beginning of the 20th century. That, of course, eroded after 1948 when many of these laws, as I mentioned, came into effect. And as a result of that, when the provincial ordinance introduced library segregation, the Cape Town City Municipality held out for a while until their subsidy was threatened. And what's quite interesting is, for example, when Group Areas Act was declared, there were pockets where people had mixed before, but had not yet been moved to the areas where were designated for them. And you had the most cynical use of mobile libraries, for example. Let's take an area like Mowbray or one like Observatory, where you had ratepayers who were both white and so-called colored. And they would use these libraries, but for a while, the municipality introduced these mobile libraries who would stop about 100 or 200 meters from the actual library, and they were, to be used by coloreds only until such time as they moved out of the area. So after that, of course, you were compelled to use the library in your own area.
Yeah. I would expect, knowing librarians being contrarians as they are, and people who were by their very nature, by what they do, interested in providing free access to information to anybody who needs it, that would chafe that requirement that if a certain person came to the door, they would have to say, no, this library is not for you. You've got to go away, and you've got to go to your own library. That I imagine with a lot of librarians, that didn't sit very well.
Yes, the responses, of course, were varied. There were cases where librarians continued, to allow users, any user, to come off the street and use the library. But again, as word got back to head offices and so forth, pressure was put on librarians until such time that they, continued to complain about the values of the profession of librarianship and the work they do. But on the other hand, they were threatened, So eventually by about the late 1960s, early 1970s, it became, by the time I was, going to libraries myself, you would end up going to a library in your own area.
Yeah. Did librarians have the opportunity to mix so that librarians who were of different groups, white, Indian, colored, black, did they in their professional capacities, in their professional associations, did they have the opportunity to get together? Or were they also in a professional sense, were they also segregated?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. Segregation was introduced into library professions in 1962. Before that, there were a few black librarians who had qualifications, who were part of the South African Library Association, but they were always in the minority. In 1962, when this was declared, the South African Library Association, being the White Library Association, took it upon themselves to nurture and to grow other library associations. So you had the emergence of the African Library Association of South Africa. There was talk about an Indian Library Association. I'm not sure if that got off the ground. But more interestingly, 2 years before the introduction of official segregation, there was a library association that started up in Cape Town itself, called itself the Cape Library Association. Effectively, it was the Colored Library Association. And that was very interesting.
Did the government involve itself in selection of books or what kind of books there were on the shelves in libraries?
Yes. If one looks at the history of censorship in the country, there were always censorship laws on the books, but they were never really used. I think in times of, for example, in the Second World War and times of other, conflict, they exercised those laws. But it was, again, only after 1948 when those laws began to be used and implemented and tightened up, so that by the 1950s you had a situation where increasingly more and more books were banned. You know, it started out with books around issues of morality. So things like James Hadley Chase or any book with a cover on with a naked leg would be banned. But eventually it became quite bizarre, so that by the 70s you had books like Black Beauty, which is a children's book, was banned. Stendhal, the French writer, his book The Red and the Black combined the two most subversive colors for the South African state, and that was also banned. And even worse, books began to be burned at state furnaces and incinerators for about 15 years.
Those other books that you mentioned, like Black Beauty, was that book banned simply because of the title?
Absolutely.
And when a book was banned, did that mean that no one could read it, or that perhaps if you had the right, if you're the right person, you had the right kind of connections, that in fact some people could read it, but generally speaking, if you walked in and you said you would like to read that book, you would be told no, and that book would not be available?
Well, I interviewed a few librarians who practiced at that time, and they told me how they had to oversee the withdrawal of thousands of books from different branch libraries, bring it into the headquarters. And they actually, the books they had there was a library in itself. And they actually had to prepare those books for pulping or, as I mentioned, for burning. And but the response, as you can imagine, it drove those books underground. So there was many of those books were circulated by hand and, it became more subversive and so on. And some of the ironies are, of course, that when these books were banned, its value increased. So there was an interesting response from some authors who said they'd like their books banned as well so that they could have, better sales.
Yeah. Did the government try to keep track of what it was that people were reading?
Yes. For example, whenever political prisoners were arrested, the books they had in their possession were often seized, and these books were often used in court cases and attempts made by state prosecutors to show links between their political activities and the contents of the books. But it was quite strange how these things worked, because they very seldom proved their cases. In one case, for example, a librarian was called to a case where this was happening, and she was able to read a list of books which were in her library, which also provided the same kind of information, for example, about communism or about the making of bombs and so forth, so that the charges against the accused were dropped, because the information that he had in books in his possession could easily be found in her public library.
Yeah. Well, when librarians were told that they were to go to the shelves of their libraries and pull off certain books and then prepared them to be sent to some sort of central place where they knew that the books were going to be destroyed, I'm sure they knew exactly what was going to happen. What did they do? How did they react? And were there, in fact, librarians who tried to fight that?
Yes, there were a few brave librarians, many of which I've been fortunate either to work with or to speak with, and I've been trying to document their memories, which I think are quite important to show some of the ways in which librarians stood up to this authoritarian regime. Unfortunately, the overwhelming atmosphere, especially in the 1960s, was one of fear. It was a very authoritarian period in South African history, and librarians generally, shied away from standing up to their own authorities. It was a fairly matronly kind of, attitude or response, and often you would find, if I can give you one specific example, mm-hmm. of a little group called... I forget their name now, but they wanted to stand up and make a point about the fact that books are important and have a universal message, and libraries play a role in this. But a group of young liberal librarians. But the only kind of protest they raised was to insist that the government's banned lists are produced in what they called accepted bibliographical style, which was something to me like saying, well, if you're going to burn books, let's at least do it in alphabetical order.
I see. Were people fired over this, or did people realize that their careers, their future, their livelihood was threatened to the point where they felt that there was really no choice, that they had to comply?
Well, there certainly were, as I mentioned, brave librarians. I know, for example, that the librarian of the National Library simply bluntly refused to remove books from his shelf. But he probably had a good excuse. He said this was a reference library. None of these books circulated in the public domain, so there's no reason for him to remove his books. But I know no cases of people actually being fired from their jobs.
Did the same thing extend to university libraries?
Yes, although university libraries did have special concessions, they were able to apply to the minister to for concessions to be able to purchase certain books, let's say in economic theory, which would include books by Marx and Lenin and so on. But again, it's very interesting. They would often keep these books in a special room for which any student or anybody wanting to use that would have to apply for special permission to use that. But they kept records, and often the police would use and have access to those records and were able then to harass people who had actually read those books.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Archie Dick. He is professor in the Department of Information Science at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. I'm going to talk about this very subject, librarians and readers in the South African anti-apartheid struggle, in a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. And anyone who is interested can attend there. This is a program in the Millercom series. They're all open to the public. Anyone who would like to attend is welcome. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in whether you can talk a little bit more about the how it is that people manage to hold on to and to circulate and to read banned books, because you said that one thing that would be guaranteed to make a book, in a sense, valuable is if the government said no one could read this book, and that people did somehow manage to have the books and pass them around. How did that happen?
Well, I've been looking at some of the ways in which student activists and political activists, in fact, did read. I can share a few stories with you. One is that one gentleman called Cecil Esau, who was a student activist in the 1970s and a colleague of mine at the University of the Western Cape, was a member of the Altis River Public Library, for example. He mentions that they would go there and they would use the so-called safe anti-communist books and use these books to actually learn more about communism. They would do so by using only the quotations taken from communist sources by the authors of these anti-communist books, who were then singled out for ridicule, and they would concentrate only on those quotations and in that way educate themselves in communism. Another example is a gentleman called Robert Krieger, who mentions that they typed up and interestingly translated into Afrikaans the book by Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is very interesting because there you have a book in the language of the oppressor, Afrikaans, and it's a book about people that are oppressed. What they did was they typed this up and circulated it amongst student activists. The security police apparently were looking for the typewriter because they had recognized a faulty R on the manuscript, and they knew which typewriter it came from. But Robert Krieger and his colleagues buried the typewriter under a palm tree in the Moravian Seminary College in Cape Town. They couldn't find the typewriter. Apparently, it still lies there today.
Mm. What was the? I would imagine that the government also was interested in trying to control, and since control the means of production, that is the means for reproducing things, so that if you wanted to print something, you wanted to print a pamphlet, you wanted to reprint something that was not available, that was also something that the government did what it could to make sure that people wouldn't actually, regular people, political activists, wouldn't be able to do that.
Yes. I would like to think, you know, that what happened in the 1980s really is a repeat in some ways of what was going on in the 1930s and 40s, which I call a Cape Library tradition. And by this I mean that there were many self-styled, I suppose, or self-made intellectuals, people like James Laguma, Johnny Gomez, Sissy Gull, Christian Zierfuchel, who used to collect books at the open markets and would invite young people from the Cape Town townships and to introduce them to books at social events like parties, you know. And Christian Zierfuchel, for example, was a librarian at the Hyman Liberman Institute, which was located in District 6, just outside at the foot of Table Mountain. And he saw the library in a very different light. You know, the library had to recognize low literacy levels in the townships. So, you know, his approach was something, if you can use a little phrase, the books were just the props, in which it recognized public performance. You know, so he would also invite leftist groups to come and debate in his library. For example, he invited the Lenin Group to debate the colored nationalists. So there was lots of oral tradition things going on. People learned about certain ideas, not from books, but from public debates and discussions in the library. You had people coming into that library very often not looking for a book, but looking for an argument. You know, so in this way, you'd have ideas diffused throughout the community, not necessarily through books, but books would be one instrumentality. The library would be one place in which it would happen. And you would also have books produced, like I mentioned now, by people like Robert Krieger. But you'd have pamphlets rolled off, photocopied in libraries. You know, I know of a case in the Bishop Lavers Township where an activist group came, and besides having meetings there, they also produced their pamphlets in the library. Mm-hmm. And librarians often helped them, show them how to make placards, what to do because of their knowledge of bookmaking and so on. So that tradition, I think, reared its head again in the 1980s.
Yeah. Well, I like that idea of the library as being a broad kind of source for information, a place for information, but also a place for people to get together for people to meet, for people to talk. And I think that that's still that's obviously still librarians today are thinking of ways to try and do make opportunities for that so that their libraries can be that also, not simply a place for you to go to get a book and not simply a building that has shelves that has all these books sitting on it, but they're looking for other ways to get people into the library and other ways that the library can serve the community.
Yes, I should also mention how political prisoners on Robben Island and in Pretoria Central, gained access to books. It was very difficult, especially in the 1960s, to get access to books, depending on your status as a political prisoner. Usually, if you were detained, which was at first a 90-day detention period, you would only have access to a Bible, if that, or other holy books of other religions. But the political prisoners themselves, with the help of the International Red Cross, with the help of local politicians like Helen Sussman, gradually gained access to books and, of course, the efforts of the political prisoners themselves. One example is Albie Sachs, who today is the Justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa. In 1964, he was in detention, and he made an application. Well, his background is law, so he knew how to use the law, and he was able to make a successful application to get access to books. Unfortunately, it was reversed very soon after that. Another example is Dennis Goldberg, one of the Rivonia trialists. He took the Minister of Prisons to court because of censorship of magazines, and it was a very difficult case, but they won, and for a long time they then started getting access to newspapers and magazines uncensored. But again, when Dennis Goldberg was released, censorship started again. So it was a very erratic process. But they got access to books. They often would have prison censors who were very poorly educated, and seemingly innocuous titles, but fairly subversive material, would come into the prison, into the prison library. So that, for example, Neville Alexander says, and he was a political prisoner, he was convicted of sabotage and working for the Yuchi Chan Club and the National Liberation Front and sentenced to 10 years. He was a brilliant scholar, prolific reader, and he mentions that he was in effect able to read books inside prison, banned books, that he would never get outside. So you ended up with political prisoners released who were probably more well-read and well-rounded than many South Africans outside of prison.
Yeah. It must have been a significant challenge for libraries after apartheid to rebuild their collections if so much material had literally been destroyed before.
Yes, and sadly, especially public libraries have not been able to catch up as quickly as the university libraries for many reasons. There is, however, many initiatives underway today, I'm happy to say. For example, the Minister of Culture, Mr. Paolo Jordan, has requested that a new formula for funding public libraries be introduced, and we're hoping that that will allow this backlog to be made up again. We know, for example, that there are collections of these banned books sitting somewhere. We don't know where they are. That needs to be looked into as well.
Mm-hmm. So the material that at one point had been banned, it had been rounded up and maybe slated for destruction, got packed into crates or locked in a room someplace, or it's in storage and no one exactly knows where it is?
That's true.
We are at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Archie Dick. He's a professor in the Department of Information Science in the University of Pretoria in South Africa, talking about librarians and libraries and the roles that they played in the anti-apartheid struggle. He'll be talking about that topic this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus. This is a MillerCom event. Anyone welcome to attend, 4 o'clock in Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. And questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, maybe we could move here into the present and talk just a little bit about the state of libraries today in South Africa, and particularly how it is they are meeting the kinds of demands or responding to the kinds of opportunities that now being in the digital age, having material available digitally, having the internet, having, I'm sure, increasing, as is the case here, increasing demands, more and more people coming to the library wanting more and more things. How are the libraries of South Africa doing in responding to all of these kinds of needs?
Well, again, one would have to distinguish between the types of libraries. Our national libraries, our national library, which now consists of two campuses, one in Cape Town and one in Pretoria, are doing reasonably well. Yeah, they, I think, have been spared from many of the ravages of the township libraries, which I worked in. The university libraries are not too badly off. The European Union has come in and donated books and donated computers and special training for staff, as well as, I think, other foundations. So, I I've been involved in assessing some of these projects. 2 years ago, I went around the country looking at most of these, what we used to call historically disadvantaged institutions. And of course, there are still pockets of, libraries that need to do a lot of catching up with others. And that's uneven. But my concern is more for the public libraries because they seem to be the poorer cousins in the family of libraries. And we have had help as well from the Carnegie Foundation. In the Cape Town, there's the Bill Gates Foundation has come in and there's a program called Smartscape, which has tried to hook up many of the libraries to the internet. Has brought its own challenges, but by and large, you know, it's making steps forward in terms of being hooked up to IT and these newer things. On the other hand, you have cases where some libraries are threatened with closure, opening hours being reduced, and so forth. So it's an uneven process. Lots to do with our legislation. Unfortunately, the constitution, the new constitution of South Africa, which we all have lots of, we're very proud of, and it left the public libraries out in the cold, in a sense, because it was a matter of who takes responsibility for this. You know, and in the past, the two tiers of government, provincial level government and local government, worked together. One would supply physical facilities like special buildings, funds, and so forth, and the other would supply the books and the staff and so on. And that kind of fell through the mat. So they're trying to rehabilitate that now in some ways. So it's uneven and slow, but certainly we're on the right path.
How did you choose this career?
That's a very interesting question. I kind of came in by the back door. You know, I'm from a working class family in Cape Town, and my own interest at school was in biochemistry. I'd always hoped to pursue a career in that area, but my dad couldn't afford to get me to university. And as a carpenter, he worked for the maintenance section of the Cape Town City Municipality and heard about these bursaries being offered to students. He discovered that the only ones that were that remained were those in librarianship. So that was money to go to university. And I'd always planned to then, you know, get in and then change and go where I wanted to. Never happened that way.
So scholarship money was available. That was the only thing. It was only for studying that. So you thought, well, okay, I'll do that. So why was it that then once you got into that field that you didn't decide to break off and do that thing that you had originally thought you might want to do?
I had a few good teachers. I did want to change after I finished my initial degree because I had to complete that given the money that had been given to me. When I finished the degree, I wanted to go in a different direction. But my professor in library and information science influenced me and said I should stay and pursue postgraduate studies in this area. I'm not sure why I listened to him, but I have no regrets.
Yeah. What is the level of literacy today in South Africa?
Well, let's put it the other way. You talk about levels of illiteracy. You know, I'm not entirely sure. You have people that put it as high as 45, 46%. But the problems are, of course, the history. You know, it was only in 1995 when schooling was made compulsory for all South African children. Until then, black children, there was no compulsory school, no law compelling kids to stay at school until, well, now you have to be there until 14 years, or what we call grade 9. And that is beginning to make a difference. That's the one thing. The other aspect, of course, is finances. You know, the books are expensive, and you very seldom find bookstores in black townships. The price of paper is very high, and most of the material being read still today are probably newspapers and popular magazines and so forth. But again, you know, there are efforts made by individuals and organizations to turn this around. So I'm very optimistic about the future in terms of improving literacy levels and developing a strong reading culture in the country.
Yeah. And just obviously there's something we touched on before, just there must be, when you're taking a look at the public libraries, there must be a big difference between the resources that some libraries and some communities can put in their libraries and others, between those places basically where people have money and those places where people don't.
That is true, but it's been, in some ways, the attempts to correct the imbalances of the past have been manipulated rather cynically. I'll give an example because I've looked into this, which is really, in some ways, a case of corruption. In the Tshwane metropole area where I stay, about 2 years ago, there was stories that broke out in the newspaper about communities were protesting that the city council wanted to close their libraries. And when I looked at it a little more closely, it looked like they were using an argument which was about redistribution. In other words, in the old white areas, which was in the southern part of the metropole, they were saying those libraries are oversupplied, and they were trying to move resources away to the northern areas, you know, to the old apartheid areas, so that it would balance things out. But it turns out that what they were really trying to do, because I looked at the timing of these developments, and it turned out just this was happening just after the announcement that South Africa had won the World Cup bid, which is due to take place in 2010. And so I think it was about a matter of moving money around and finding soft targets to take money away from. And so they used this, you know, this argument. I mean, ideally, you know, to correct things, what they should be doing is building new libraries in those old areas so that you don't, because you still have, in the old white areas, you have poor whites who rely on those libraries to have access to books, to have access to the internet. So why punish them, you know? So, this is happening, but one has to be very careful about how it happens and what motives are behind that.
How widespread is internet access now in South Africa?
I can't quote statistics to you, but again, it follows the pattern of income and poverty and wealth and so on. So you would have lots of internet access in wealthy homes at universities, but you do have internet cafes all around the country. But again, it's difficult to afford. The big thing that has grown and has been used as a kind of platform for many, let's say the health department to spread information about TB and AIDS, has been the mobile phone, because that has taken off in a big way. So you'd find in rural areas, before you have internet access, you have people who have mobile phones, and that's been used successfully.
Yeah. And is there, I would imagine that is probably, as is the case here in the United States, that now increasingly one of the things that people want when they go to the library is they want internet access there. If they can't have it at their home, they can't have internet, they can't have a computer, at least they can go to library and access a kind of terminal that is publicly available. That's something that a kind of need that libraries are working to try to satisfy?
Yes. As I've mentioned, largely they've depended on outside support, you know, like large donations and so on, with the idea that they'd become financially viable. So the idea is that once they have this, let's say in the Bill Gates Foundation case, that it would become part of their annual, the regular budget. And after four or 5 years, they'd be able to manage it on their own, you know, things like repair, improvement, and so forth. But it is unequal across the country. But the general thrust is towards greater internet access, greater access to all kinds of IT equipment in libraries.
Would you say that there had been in South Africa a reading culture, or was this something that was very? I suppose that it would be class dependent, it would be income dependent, it would be dependent on how much education people have. So that it would, the answer to that question, I suppose, would be yes, but it would depend on what segment of society you were talking about.
I think you're quite right. It is a yes but answer. You know, the people are inclined to say, people in South Africa today, that there is no reading culture, especially no reading culture among blacks. That's not true. Some of my research has been to dig into the past and to find cases where you have had, you know, pockets of what my colleague calls passionate reading. I'll give you one example. On the mission stations in the late 19th century, for example, you had missionaries who would use their, you know, printing facilities to print, of course, especially religious literature. But after a while, many of these things were printed more centrally, and then they had these you know, printing facilities and nothing to print. What they did then was to start little newspapers. And often in these newspapers, they'd have letters to the editor. And these letters to the editor would be written by, in one case I've looked at, by Tswana speaking people in their language, a language that just been developed earlier. So it was often widely read by other Tswana speakers and readers. And for a number of years, as that, depending on the finance for the newspaper, you'd have a pocket of passionate reading, you know. Or you'd have, in the case of when public libraries developed in the rural areas, in the Cape, the old Cape Colony, as we called it then, started out as reading groups of fairly well-to-do gentlemen, usually, would have these reading societies and so on. But then as they grew, as they expanded and they sought state subsidies, you know, to keep growing, the state said yes, but then you would have to open your libraries for one day a week, you know, to the community. What happened as a result was that you had black people coming into the library just to look at the pictures, you know, and of course it caused lots of consternation among the members of this reading society. But eventually you find these people had this hunger and a thirst for reading. And because these were fairly much Protestant missionaries, the idea was to teach people to read and to read the Bible for themselves. So there was a reading culture slowly developing. You have cases where a missionary would write back to his head office and be in despair, saying, you know, people have come for 1 year and left. But if you look at what happened, you find that many of them learned just enough literacy to be able to use it for themselves, a kind of functional literacy, if you will. I, for example, have come across letters that have been written from young people working on the farm to their lovers, to their husbands, who were away fighting the wars, you know, for the British colony, for the British Empire. So if you look into all these little cases, you'll find there was, in fact, a reading culture.
Is there, what is kind of demand, and particularly, I guess, what kind of availability is there for books and other printed material that is in some language other than English?
Not much is the short answer. Hmm. And it has to do, again, with the usual thing, the will to, you know, to develop these languages, the educational policies, and the demands of parents. I've been to a school about a few years ago, I've been to a library a few years ago in Soweto, a township just outside Johannesburg. And I found that there were rows and rows of shelves of books in the vernacular languages, and asked the librarian, you know, aren't these books being read? And they said, unfortunately not. The parents insist that the children read English books. So it's a combination of factors which is keeping the real flourishing of press in these languages from really growing as it should.
Yeah, so no doubt that parents are feeling that for their children's success, it's important that they have facility and read and write and work in English, and that whatever other languages might be part of their tradition is just not as important.
Unfortunately, that appears to be the case.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus, and we have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus, I'd just like to introduce again for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Professor Archie Dick. He's professor in the Department of Information Science at the University of Pretoria in South Africa and is here visiting the campus. We'll be talking about librarians, libraries, readers in South Africa, particularly the role that libraries played in the anti-apartheid struggle. I'll be talking this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus in the Knight Auditorium of Spurlock Museum. It's a Millercom event. Also has some sponsorship from the folks at the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences. It is open to anyone who would like to attend. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. That's the number here if you'd like to join in the conversation. Just as a way of going back and doing some summing up, I would imagine that over your career as a librarian or someone who has been involved in information sciences, things have changed very dramatically.
Yes, that is true. I remember when I started out as a student, you know, we learned fairly much a broad liberal arts approach to librarianship, and included things like bibliography and library history and the broad classification of knowledge and so forth. In addition to the techniques of librarianship, the practical sides, what has happened in my lifetime, as I've reflect on it, not that I'm very old, but for the past, I've been in it for more than 20 years now, is that unfortunately, or perhaps because of the pressures and changes and so on going on in the world of IT, that some of these themes have had to give way, you know, to the newer emphases on IT and so on, which is a good thing in many ways. But I think librarianship is about books and readers and a wider set of institutions in society that deal with the flow of knowledge and ideas and so forth. I believe, for example, that the anti-apartheid struggle was a struggle about ideas, you know, ideas of equality, segregation, ideas of the armed struggle and reconciliation and education for liberation instead of liberation before education, and so on and so forth. And I believe libraries played a role in diffusing those ideas through books, through debates in the space of the library, and so forth. So I do see libraries also as part of that wider set of institutions in society.
I just came across a reference to a talk you must have given now something like 10 years ago when you were here in the United States, and about the fact that at least at that time there seemed to be a kind of a gulf between librarians and between people who define themselves as IT people or information science people. And admittedly, this was 10 years ago, but at looking at this, I kind of thought, well, gosh, isn't that all one world? Now, we talk about library and information science as being one thing, and certainly librarians, a lot of librarians around the world, have taken to all of the things that you can do digitally with information now. Is that still the case, that in South Africa, the librarians see that they're sort of one group and they do one thing, and people who work with information technology somehow and do that perhaps more in a working with businesses, that they those kinds of people still see themselves as being sort of in two different territories, and that they don't see that somehow that's all one common enterprise?
Yes, I can just tell you the context of the talk I gave 10 years ago was to show how I kind of analyzed the situation as being driven primarily by teaching departments. I kind of suspected a political motive behind it as well, because it's usually a combination of factors. And the pressure on departments like librarianship, where with dwindling numbers, to show some kind of return on the investment made by the university authorities, led them to look for new markets, to add things like information management and so on and so forth to their courses and attract other kinds of people. So what happened was you found that traditional librarianship, was scaled back more and more. And I often wondered whether it was a good thing, given our history, that we still needed to develop and almost redevelop public librarianship and traditional areas of librarianship as distinct from these other areas. Not that they cannot help, of course they can, but it seemed as if it was tilting in for me in the wrong direction. I now, for example, find myself in a faculty of engineering, my department of information science is in the School of Information Technology, along with two other schools, the School of Computer Science and the School of Information Systems. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing in many ways. We have more students numbers now, and we are able to use some of the librarianship or traditional library courses and to filter that among students and or force them to take some of these things. So it's been a combination of a matter of survival as well as acknowledging that things have in fact changed. And you're quite right in saying that the world of libraries and the world of information and businesses and so forth are coming together, and it presents a special challenge to educators as well as employers.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about how when the internet was still a relatively young idea, when people were being introduced to the concept, and when the personal computer was not quite as widespread as it is today, that people were raising questions about, well, what does that mean for the future of the library? Mm-hmm. And does the brick and mortar institution of the library as we know it, particularly the maybe not so much the major university research libraries, but the community library, the public library, now that if everyone is going to have a machine like this in their house and going to be hooked up to the internet, well, what do you need the library for? And I think that there was a moment, maybe it was a brief moment, but there was a moment where people were talking about the death of the library, and that it seemed like, fortunately, that didn't happen, and that a lot of places, certainly in our community, libraries are thriving institutions. They seem to be busier than they ever have been before, perhaps because they're offering a somewhat wider range of services before, but they're very thriving places. So it seems that actually that the digital age so far, we can say, has actually been good for the library.
Yes, I suppose in many ways, when a new technology comes along, there is this bells and whistles approaches and people forecasting the end of things. If we go back to the introduction of television and new forms in which information is stored. You had again and again, stories that libraries will not survive this. But what's happened is that libraries have incorporated many of these technologies and in many cases, as I look around at libraries in the U.S., have in fact be better off for it. And I think in South Africa, most people are looking to the library to provide access to the internet, and that's probably a good thing for libraries and for books and for the traditional values that libraries represent as well.
Yeah. But then, again, just going back to the what we were talking before, it presents an even greater challenge for libraries to try to figure out how it is they're going to meet that need. So funding becomes probably even more pressing issue than it ever has been before, because libraries are being asked to do more, and I'm sure the libraries and librarians are saying, well, we'll be happy to do that, but we can't do it if we don't have the resources to do it.
Of course, yes, that's the eternal question, always looking for more money. And librarians are often involved in things like advocacy and trying to get more money out of politicians. But it's a difficult process, but one that is often, needs to be fought by going to the public themselves and convincing them that libraries are important. So that they would support. And we have what's grown in number in South Africa are what we call Friends of the Library groups. There are many of them, and they often bring in funds in many different ways and help out in libraries. In the Western Cape alone, there are over 40 of them, and across the country probably many, many more. And these are ways in which one can supplement the income and so forth of libraries.
Well, there we're going to have to stop it. We've come to the end of the time. If people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana who would like to hear more from our guest, Archie Dick, he's professor in the Department of Information Science at University of Pretoria in South Africa. He'll be talking about librarians and readers in the South African anti-apartheid struggle this afternoon at 4 o'clock in Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory Street in Urbana. It's an event in the Millercom series, also with some sponsorship from the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. Again, that's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's open to anyone who would like to attend. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.